Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Own Personal Beatles with me, Robin Allender, and...
My name's Jack Pelling, still.
Hello. Welcome to the show. This week we've got an excellent guest. It's Ed Dowie, who is a fantastic musician, songwriter, singer. His album The Obvious Eye came out last year and is absolutely wonderful. We had some good chats about the Beatles and kind of more, it got a bit existential at the end as we relaxed into each other's company, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, we talked about sort of the inherent merits of music, what makes it good. Quite a lofty subject.
Yeah, lots to talk about there. But Ed's own music is fantastic, and I kind of, it's quite uncategorizable, I would say. Yeah. So it's kind of, we start kind of by talking about that, by talking about his own specific influences and how the Beatles kind of fit into his own kind of influences.
Yeah, and his album, The Obvious Eye, that it was one of my albums of the year last year, is absolutely amazing. I think it was one of Six Music's albums of the year. So we chat about his sort of process, and, you know, how he makes music and where he sort of draws those inspirations from. And he's really interesting. He's got some fascinating techniques of immersive music writing practices and stuff, which is really fabulous. And we talk about Travis.
Yeah. And we talk about, well, we go around the houses a lot, but we also talk about Ludovico Einaudi, which we should kind of contextualize a bit. Basically, we start talking about a review of Ludovico Einaudi, who's a composer and musician that was in The Guardian in 2019, which sort of did the rounds a bit at the time because it was a one-star review. And we kind of talk about the kind of concepts that the journalist is writing about in that review, which makes for quite an interesting chat.
Yeah, so all that to look forward to. We're going to do weekly winnings this week, but I think we're going to do it at the end of the show because we've got a lot to cover before we crack on with Ed Dowie. But this week sees the re-release of the Concert for George, which was the tribute concert put on for George Harrison in 2002 at the Royal Albert Hall, star-studded. I used to have it on DVD. So I know it very well, but you got a little preview of the jazzed up Dolby Atmos 4K version the other day.
Yes, thanks so much to Danny Barnard, who invited us along to a screening of the Concert for George at the Dolby facility in Soho Square. It was absolutely fantastic to see it again, and it sounded phenomenal. Mm. And Danny Harrison was there himself.
Amazing. So
I got to say hello to him, and he was a lovely, lovely guy, so humble and so enthused about his father's music. You know, just incredible watching it. You know, he was 24 when he was playing in it, and it's just such a lot to be kind of dealing with, and he deals with it all so well.
And I think it was the first sort of time that, because he's not really been that much in the public eye, so it was the first time we saw him on sort of big platform.
Yeah.
I remember people falling over themselves at the time because in 2002 he looked so like George.
Yeah.
It was really uncanny, and because there's behind him there's all these pictures of George when he's young, and you do find yourself double taking a bit in that.
Yeah, and obviously the concert is incredibly moving, but you know, watching it now from 20 years distance is even more so, because you know, since then we've lost Billy Preston, Terry Jones, Neil Innes, Ravi Shankar, Tom Petty.
Eric Clapton.
Lost in a different way. But, you know, so it's got that kind of added level of kind of sadness to it, you know, but it really is so good. I mean, Billy Preston's performance, you know, isn't it a pity?
My Sweet Lord, yeah.
My Sweet Lord. And the thing that really got me was Ringo doing Photograph. I just thought it was so moving. Ringo comes on, and there's something so strange, and he has this natural eccentricity about him, and there's something kind of other about him, and he brings so much colour to the performance. And I mean, it's a poignant song anyway, but you know, I found that really, really moving.
Did they show the whole of the Ravi Shankar first half then?
No. It's kind of, it's edited together in the same way the the previous release of it was. But the Ravi Shankar bit is beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love the ending. The Joe Brown bit gets me every time. Mm. In a more simple world before hipsters and ukuleles collided.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, but please go to concertforgeorge.com because it is being screened around the world on November the 29th, which is the anniversary. So you can see it's in Argentina, it's in Australia, it's in Brazil, it's in Chile, it's in Mexico, it's in New York, it's in Hungary. It's all over the world. But yeah, if you're near a cinema that's showing it, do go along because it really is worth seeing on the big screen. And one more thing, the Blu-ray audio will be released in February next year, so that's worth pre-ordering now. And the other thing I wanted to say about Danny Harrison, he actually told me something which is really funny, which is that he edited the DVD credits for when it was released on DVD and forgot to put his own name on it. So there you go, that's from the Dark Horse's mouth.
There you go. I mean, I doubt Lewison's got that fact. Superb. So should we have a little bit of correspondence?
Yes, please.
Let's do it. This is an email from James Taylor, presumably not the singer-songwriter or the executive producer of Taskmaster, who I did have a nice chat with about Paperback Writer yesterday. So nice. Could be him. But if it is, hi, James. Dear Jack and Robin, thank you both very much for YOPB and all the joy it brings on a weekly basis. It really has encouraged me to go on some deeper dives in the last few years and has unearthed some real treasures I was formerly not aware of. This has led me to mentally make a list of favourite Beatles moments, i.e. those little sections, whether it be just a note, a chord, a bar or phrase, etc., that really stick out and get you every time. There are some big hitters, i.e. the final chord of A Day in the Life, the comical anvil hits in Maxwell's Silverhammer, or the pan across after the intro of Here Comes the Sun. I just wondered, what were some of your favourites? Some, but not all, of mine include the opening note in I Feel Fine that pans across and rings out, the 16th shuffle that is presumably a tambourine in Paperback Writer. I noticed this more, or it became more prominent in the take 1 and 2 / backing track version on the super deluxe version of Revolver, but makes the song instantly more funky. The single high-pitched note from Nowhere Man at the end of the guitar solo, which I think you use in one of your jingles. Good spot, we do, although it's actually not the same harmonic. I changed it so we didn't get in trouble. I'd be interested to hear some of your favourite moments. Keep up the good work. Regards, James. So we've talked recently about some of those sort of transportative Beatle moments that you look forward to every time you listen to them. What were yours? You particularly like the end of Magical Mystery Tour?
Oh, yeah, the kind of acid trip jazz bar vibe of that I obviously love. I mean, if it's little moments, I mean, a moment I always love just because it's, I guess, like a lovely human kind of moment. And John Lennon in I Want You, She's So Heavy, changing pickup switch on his guitar, you know, and the little breaks, that you can hear that little kind of click. And, it's just one of those amazing kind of moments where you're kind of in the room a bit with them.
Yeah.
I love the human touches. I love John's vocal performance in And Your Bird Can Sing, where the last time round, he kind of goes, "But you won't see me," like that. And it's almost like he's belting it a bit, you know?
Mm.
And it's just a slightly different kind of performance. It's really human. I love things like that. What about you?
I like a lot of the moments where a bit of prominent sort of scouse slips in. There's a few examples of that. But in terms of sort of big moments that I look forward to every time, I don't know, I mean, the fanfare return of Never Give You Your Money in the medley. There's quite a few moments in the medley. The Lookout. Any sort of, you know, blisters on my fingers.
Yeah, A up.
Yeah, exactly, all that stuff. Yeah, I'll be thinking about it more consciously, though, now.
Yeah.
That's a lovely email. And if you have any particular Beatles moments like that, then do get in touch. You can email us, jack@homespunsounds.com, or get in touch with us on social media at Personal Beatles on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and the like. If you're enjoying the show and you want to show your appreciation and you listen on Apple Podcasts, you can always leave us a review. We enjoy reading them. It's very nice to see them, and 5-star reviews help other people find the podcast and help us get featured and stuff like that. So that would be superb. This episode coming up with Ed Dowie is going to be extended for subscribers. So if you want to go to patreon.com/personalbeatles and subscribe there, you can, and get ad-free early episodes of everything this series, as well as all the extended versions of previous series and some bonus eps. We've got another one coming up soon. Then you can do that. And you can also subscribe from within the Apple Podcasts app. We'll crack on with the fantastic Ed Dowie, and we'll be back at the end of the show with a bit of Weekly Wings, and we'll tell you a little bit about what's coming up over Christmas. For now, here's the brilliant Ed Dowie.
This week, our guest is Ed Dowie. We're delighted to welcome him to the podcast. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Robin.
How's it going?
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Good, good.
All good.
You said off mic that you're recording a new album or in the middle of at the moment.
Yeah.
How is that coming along?
It's good, I think. I mean, it's bad some days, but it's definitely all consuming at the moment. So.
Mm. How long does it typically take you?
I've no idea, but there was a day where I thought, I think I've started my album today, which was, I think, in May or something. Mm. And I'm hoping to finish it next month.
Oh, right. So you're quite far through the process.
Yeah. Though. Well, oh, nice. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. Mm. But I'm enjoying it. So
it's really, I mean, obviously, like, we're friends. But I feel like it's quite weird to talk to you in this kind of way. But when I said that uncategorizable thing at the start, I do think that is true for a lot of your songs. Do you have a specific set of influences that you're kind of thinking of when you're writing a song, or do you let the song happen?
I definitely have no idea.
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely more just doing something and trying to listen to what it wants or what I want it to want.
Mm. How do you usually get categorised in music press or by labels?
I don't know, and I've never been very good at myself at describing other things.
Yeah.
And, if, you know, when you meet someone and they say, oh, what kind of music, you know, you're a musician, what do you make? I have a really boring, not very informative response, which is, oh, it's sort of a bit experimental and electronic and I sing. But I quite like, it has been described as odd pop.
Odd pop. Right,
which I quite like, because I feel if someone else described something as odd pop, I'd want to hear that.
Mm. Yeah, that sounds much more intriguing than, like, art rock or
something
else that could be odd pop adjacent.
Yeah.
It seems like very for me it feels like there's a classical influence, maybe because of the piano playing, or the kind of minimalism influence.
Mm.
When I first heard your stuff, I thought of Wim Martens. Do you know him at all?
No,
the Belgian composer. Just very, very kind of kind of a bit. He was a big influence on Jan Tiersen, actually.
Oh, really?
My former boss. But that kind of very nicely constructed, very melodic, minimal classical music, a kind of like a Philip Glasgow's pop kind of vibe.
Oh, wow. I really like it when someone says, "Oh, that reminds me of someone," because it's usually someone I've never heard of. Or I'll listen to them and either love it or be offended.
Yeah, have a listen. There's a great song called Their Duet, which is very, very nice. But definitely one of the most striking things, I think, about your music is your sense of melody. I think you're a brilliant writer of melodies, which brings us on to the Beatles. So where do the Beatles sit in your influence house?
If you'd asked me that question a couple of years ago, and in fact when you started the podcast and you said to me, do you like the Beatles?
Mm.
My answer was like, yeah, I don't know. I honestly didn't really know.
Yeah.
And it was only when I started, to be honest, this is kind of an odd one, because your podcast has actually been part of that, a big part of that journey in a way, because listening to it and the sort of emphasis on the personal with people's relationship with the band made me realising how much they were part of my childhood, as much as I do have a kind of classical background to a degree, because my dad's a musician and conducts choirs and plays the organ and the piano and stuff.
Right.
Mm. So, and I grew up singing in the choir, and then I played the organ and stuff. But the only pop records, if you like, that my parents had were Beatles records.
Mm.
So they were, I loved them. And it's only, you know, looking back, because they were so just ubiquitous in my growing up, you can forget about them in a way, how important they were.
Yeah.
So it's been really wonderful the last couple of years, just sort of rediscovering them a bit, to be honest.
That's great.
It's strange, the sort of classical music relationship with the Beatles, particularly in the way it's taught, because I grew up with a pretty much exclusively classical music kind of education.
Right.
But they were always, from very early on, they were in a lot of books, and, you know, orchestras would play them at family-friendly events or something, and then they were on arrangements for jazz and stuff like that. I think they were appreciated by those musicians, and people like Leonard Bernstein and stuff talked about the Beatles in the way that probably no other like contemporary band have been treated sort of ubiquitously positively by classical musics, who tend to have quite a kind of knee jerk. I guess that made them slightly uncool for quite a lot of people. It would be like the fun song that you do at the end of term in a choir or something. Like
yeah, Beatles song or we're going to sing Let It Be today.
Yeah.
Yeah. But did you sort of learn Beatles songs? What were your instruments when you grew up?
I learned the piano and then later the organ. And I remember having a Beatles songbook. And it's interesting, I can't remember, I think it was the guy from Architects, was it, a few weeks ago. And you spoke about, you feel like in a sort of kind of classical or orchestral environment that McCartney gets more of a
for sure.
And I remember there were certain songs in this piano book, and maybe it's partly to do with the arrangement, but something like Strawberry Fields, I remember trying to play that on the piano, and it just it sounds rubbish.
Yeah. Really?
you try and play that melody, it just, where is it? Well, you know.
And they're also really badly notated, which is something we kind of touched on in recent episode as well. But sort of so many of those books that you could buy at quite considerable cost were very sort of reductive because they were trying to sort of simplify the things. And Paul's kind of melodies, because they have such a kind of obvious form that they're quite easy to sort of reharmonize. And whereas like John's stuff is, it's so harmonically ambiguous a lot of the time that if you try and make straight 1-4-5 chords out of it, it just sounds quite bland.
Right, so what you mean, so like, I think I was talking about recently, so like Bill Frisell, the guitarist, covers Julia, and just to get that single note melody working takes so much kind of skill. In the delivery of it.
Well, because it's so much more about what's going on underneath it and the melody's relationship with what the chordal stuff is doing.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas Paul's is, you know, Paul writes melodies like Andrew Lloyd Webber, you know. that's not a criticism, you know. It sounds pretty damning.
So was it that you didn't like the John songs, or you just thought they didn't work in that context?
I loved them, but I just was very disappointed with some of trying to play these, some of the songs. Like, I mean, I think that's probably it, actually, the sort of the way things get simplified.
Yeah.
It's easier to simplify for whatever reason.
I think Beatles are such a cool chords band. I think when you play the guitar, you either get into doing riffs or doing learning chords.
Right, yeah, what, that's a good
were
theory.
You chords or riffs?
Chord guy.
I'm a chord guy.
Yeah.
Not many riffs on your last record.
No, it's kind of riff light.
So how old were you when you were learning piano and having this Beatles book?
I think I learned the piano pretty early, from about 4 or 5 or something, because my dad taught me. Actually, no, I think my gran taught me to begin with, and my dad taught me. So I was surrounded by music from a very early age. And it's interesting, I don't know, you get to a certain point in life where you start looking back and realising where your influences come from and stuff, because that's something I've never been aware of. It's only afterwards you think, oh, actually, that makes loads of sense.
Yeah.
But sort of realising the sort of power of music and and feeling really lucky to be introduced to that at a young age, and to be introduced to that's a good thing and a fine thing, you know, like crying over music and crying over something because it's beautiful or because it's sad or because it's amazing. Mm. And I don't know. I feel like a lot of people probably don't have that kind of.
No, experience. I think it's if you grow up in a musical family, I assume that's more natural. Have you got siblings that were musicians and stuff?
Not really. They sort of learnt instruments, but then didn't really carry on particularly. But they like music. Mm. I mean, one of my earliest musical memories is being absolutely terrified. My dad was rehearsing Peter and the Wolf with a singer or something, and I just remember that being utterly terrified. I had to leave the house.
Really?
Of the wolf theme on the...
A big, grey wolf came out of the forest.
Revisiting the Beatles sort of years later, it's been amazing just realising all those songs that had such an impact. When I listen to them now, it's still, you know, it's so moving. Mm. I think I remember texting you at one point just saying I'm in tears listening to She's Leaving Home.
Mm. Yeah.
And I don't know, it's wonderful to kind of reflect on that and realise, to appreciate things that maybe were just everywhere and you can take it for granted.
Mm. Yeah, I think Pepper is such a kind of emotional record. But I've never been able to separate whether that's because it's the first one that I sort of really played on repeat and jammed it into my head. And I remember being quite frightened of Good Morning, Good Morning. And that's probably why I don't it to this day. But I think, it was so cacophonous and those horns were quite overwhelming.
I think that's just something, when you're surrounded by music as a child, listening to it when you grow up, there's something just visceral about it. I mean, I've had this just through listening to Revolver a lot recently with, the new box set and everything, that Yellow Submarine conjures this image in my mind. And as soon as I try and picture it, it's gone. Kind of, there's this world it creates. I can't put my finger on it.
Wow.
You know, but it's like a lot of things from childhood, and music just had that very powerful connection. I always feel lucky that I grew up in the 80s, where the pop music in the 80s was just amazing, really, with Tears for Fears and Depeche Mode or something, Wham as well, just huge choruses.
Yeah.
And I think that was a big thing for me and my brother. It was like, why is that chorus so good? Why is that melody so good? Like the Aztec Camera as well. I don't know, and Jude Rogers writes really, really well about this in her book, but this idea that somehow just certain melodies just have something special about them. And then the Beatles obviously just were just so skilled at that, just having just melodies that kind of feeling of, you know, they sound like you've heard them before.
Mm.
So there's something almost mystical about it, you know.
Yeah.
Do you think that is specifically an 80s thing, or do you think that's because you grew up in... Because I would say a similar thing about sort of early 90s pop music that I was never really into, but if you listen to sort of Now records from the early 90s, melody was king on radio, you know, pop radio music stations.
Yeah.
And the way that music was written, I suppose, because it was, you know, there's kind of hit factory mentality where
can you give a specific example of 90s?
Well, basically there's a game that I quite like to play when we're quite pissed in the summer around when someone's got a speaker or whatever, where you go through a Now and you have to guess which one it is.
Right.
And I was just always struck by TLC songs or whatever they are. Okay, they're just do I remember them, you know, instantly after hearing a bar because there were I was that age to hear them, or were melody more important than, and now we live in a kind of more, there's more emphasis on rhythm, I suppose. Post-hip-hop being the predominant pop music.
Right.
Maybe people are now more interested in rhythm and percussion and beats and stuff.
Yeah, I think there's something in that. And obviously, it's to do with being a child in the 80s, but I do think there is something very interesting about the 80s. It was this kind of peculiarly bombastic decade. And it was kind of quite similar to the 60s, I think, in some ways, because there was so much this mad celebratory music. Like Queen Live at Wembley,
I don't think could have happened in any other decade.
Yeah.
Because there's something so sincere about it, so without irony, in this, you know. And I think in many ways that's what we are drawn to about 60s music. It's so purely expressed.
You're kind of lucky to, in some ways, to live in that, to grow up in that era. And before the 90s and all the sort of cynicism that sort of, you know, the, it was bombastic and it was like, you know, unashamedly big and brash and things. That's quite a wonderful thing, really.
I mean, we all hate Thatcher. We're not, you know, it's not, don't want anyone to think that's what we're going for with this.
Talking of the 80s and melody, you said that you've been listening to Pipes of Peace this week, which I've got in my record collection. So, and we, I thought we'd refresh our memories of it early, earlier. But what what made you whip out your peace pipe?
It's kind of interesting you said about the thing of do you like it because it was you were at the right time, because I wanted to, I think I'd listened to So Bad Is It or So Sad. What's that one where he sings really high?
Well, yeah, and we were just remarking on how lovely that
and
is.
And
So Bad.
I saw that. I saw that it was on Pipes of Peace, and I thought, I don't know that album, so I listened to that album, and the songs I knew, I loved, and then the other ones I was not so impressed with, and it was interesting thinking. Is this just because I liked these when I was young, or you know, what about it? And it really made me laugh when, as an example of that average person song, when that came on, I thought, this is absolutely ridiculous, and it really made me laugh. The thought of maybe big Michael Jackson fans kind of buying this album, because there's a couple of Michael Jackson songs in there, and then listening to that, like, what the hell is this? But then after listening to it, I kind of just found myself thinking about it, and then listening to it. I've listened to it about, I don't know, about 10 times in the last week.
Wow.
And I still can't decide quite what I think about it. Is it awful, or is it some kind of strange genius?
Is it one of the songs that
I've got a suspicion it might be the former.
is it a song where you're listening to, and someone's on the pleasure pain principle?
Absolutely. I mean, it's all those kind of, you know, the end of the line repeating. Waitress.
My favourite line is, I met a woman working as a waitress, so I asked what she did. I mean, it's self-explanatory. And it just goes on for so. There's three verses. If you haven't heard this song, it's basically Paul McCartney's got a big thing about, I suppose, just the ordinariness. I mean, that's his big subject, really. So this is one of his big songs about ordinariness, as the title suggests. So he meets an engine driver in the first verse who says that what he really wants to do is work with lions in a zoo. Then in the second verse, he meets a waitress who wanted to be a sort of Hollywood actress, but the part was given to a kid. Yes, sir, you heard it right.
I love those end of the line. Like, it sort of slows down and gets really sort of maudlin on the line. But the part was given to a kid.
It sounds like he's making it up.
Why?
And what's the last verse? A boxer.
He wanted to be taller. That's
a lovely line. He looked into the corners of his memory. That's a great lyric, isn't it?
Great.
But he always said he had a feeling that he lacked a little extra height.
Yeah.
So is that, that's it.
These few years are definitely his artistic low points, I think. Or have the potential to be. Because this is the Paul of Give My Regards to Broad Street, where he's kind of obsessed with this idea of being normal, isn't it? It's almost like a fantasy of the man who's got everything. Who just desperately wants to be a waitress.
I've definitely got a real soft spot for that. I mean, I love Give My Regards to Broad Street. I mean, the album. I've probably only seen the film once in years ago.
So that's enough.
It's probably not as good as I remember. But I remember, like, all those orchestral bits in there. I loved all
of some of the music and the arrangements.
And the Beatles songs are fantastic.
But
there's a line in here on Keep Undercover on Pipes of Peace that I find really disappointing, where he says, well, what good is butter if you haven't got bread? I mean, it's not great. But then, what good is art when it hurts your head? I mean, this is the Paul of What about Carnival of Light? You know,
I think he's in a sort of Randy Newman-esque character.
His character, yeah. Is it?
Okay. It's a Stuart Lee.
What's
character.
The bin lid one?
Oh, the bin lid one. Yeah, this is a
What's
great
the
lyric.
Bin lid one?
The Other Me.
The Other Me, which is pretty bad. But as we were discussing, it's got this kind of sprinkle of Paul McCartney magic on it, where it's just so listenable.
Yeah.
And the melody is so brilliant.
He can't help write a good song, basically.
Yeah, but some of the lyrics, as I'm sure you're about to...
I know I was a crazy fool for treating you the way I did, but something took hold of me and I acted like a dustbin lid. It's great.
It's the greatest songwriter of his generation. Yeah.
But I mean,
it gives you hope, though, doesn't it?
I wrote down in my notes here, "Pipes of Peace, Outsider Art?" Question mark. Because it's like what you're saying about average person, a Michael Jackson fan listening to it. Like, what is it? What kind of music is this?
Yeah, it's incredibly like produced and I feel like somebody else could have made that song. And put so much work into it, and it would be the best thing they've ever made.
Yeah,
I'm still not saying it's good.
I think so many great Beatles songs. They came up with the song, and then it was like, how should we do it? And it's like, well, let's try and sound like The Who, or you know, let's try and sound like, you know, a gospel song, or you know, let's kind of contextualize it somehow. But when you just have the song, it's weird how that kind of all falls away, and like you're kind of left with this, like, well, what am I actually trying to do? So I find it kind of quite fascinating, Pipes of Peace, because it's sort of stuck between this, like, I'm not really sure what kind of music this is, and that kind of makes it really interesting.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of that in that era, though, isn't there? Because there's a whole new sort of paint palette in terms of all these drum machines and these really over the top. Everyone's going a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
And I guess if you're 45-year-old Paul or whatever you are, 40-year-old Paul, and you're in probably a bit of a musical identity crisis anyway, you just nab Michael Jackson because you can.
Because you can,
But it's still really good, though. I mean, it's still a good album.
Yeah, I mean, my friend/enemy of the show bought me that for my birthday as a sort of ironic present because he's a Beatles skeptic. The joke was on him because it's
good. Great. Song.
Yeah,
it's great.
I mean, there's I'm average person. I think I'm probably coming down on the anti side of the fence.
Pipes of Peace, but, the song is really beautiful.
Yeah, and So Bad is really great. Like one of the great solo Paul songs.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful.
Listening to Anthology 3, there's that version of Junk on there. And I love that. I think that's absolutely amazing, but I don't like the version on McCartney or whatever.
Really?
They're quite similar, aren't they?
They're very similar, but there's something in that I feel like I'm constantly, probably everyone, you know, feels like that, I'm constantly worried about, of sort of improving a song, inverted commas, and making it worse, you know. There's always that thing of, like, if you keep working on something, and how do you know? I'm sure Paul thinks it's much better on thing, but there's something amazing about the sort of rough quality of that one, and there's like little bits of feedback and sort of half done lyrics and stuff, and I think it's amazing.
I think it still feels really unfinished on McCartney. You know, but that's so funny, isn't it? How can you write such an amazing little hook and a beautiful melody, and then you just cannot, you know, it's like you've reached the end of the road creatively and you can't do anything apart from repeat the verses and do a bit of whistling or whatever. But that was probably why he missed, you know, collaborating so much, because there must have been a few situations like that where someone comes and picks it up and writes a new bit to it and finishes it off, and you must feel kind of almost bereaved of your creative partner when you have something that good and you just can't make it work.
There's a brilliant orchestral version of it. Have you heard that? It worked. I mean, no, it kind of goes back to what we were saying, but it works so well.
Really?
With an orchestra. It's just such a beautiful melody.
Do you like listening to the Anthology stuff?
I had the number 3, you know, whenever it came out.
Mm.
And that one I absolutely loved. I guess that's the period that I liked the most, especially at that point. And, yeah, I think that's one of those ones where it really conjures up a period in my own kind of life. I went to university when I was 18, and I it didn't actually last very long. I was only there for 6 months and dropped out. But that whole period is summed up in that. And I listened to that album over and over and over again.
Mm.
The course I did there was this contemporary art course.
Mm.
And I wasn't ready to go to university. And I kind of blagged my way onto this course and didn't really know anything about contemporary art, if I'm completely honest. And I had to, the first project I had to do.
What good is art when it hurts your head? I mean.
Yeah.
Indeed, as a wise man once said. And the first project you had to do, you could just do anything you like and it would be presented to the whole year and stuff. So I absolutely didn't know what to do because I don't think I'd actually ever made anything really. Mm. So I, you know, I think they're called rebuses or a rebus, you know, like a puzzle where it's kind of pictures and letters.
Mm.
So if it was the word at, it would be a picture of a cat with a C crossed out.
That's the Scottish
detective. What that's what he's named after. Rebus is
I did not know that. Yeah. There we go.
I did one of those on sort of A1 paper of the whole of the song Maxwell Silver Hammer.
Really?
Yeah. And it was pretty awful.
Well,
I remember
good.
People looking at it going, oh, and trying to be nice about it. Mm. But
yeah. Do you still have it?
No, I got rid of it.
Why Maxwell Silver Hammer?
I don't know. I think I was just listening to that album a lot. And I just really liked it.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, I loved that song. I really, you know.
That's a podcast first.
Yeah.
I always really liked it as a child. Mm. And then I think I let people convince me it was bad. But now
that's the trouble, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Where does your actual opinion lie somewhere?
Yeah.
I remember listening. I love that thing where you listen to a song that you listen to as a child and you completely remember the feeling of it, listening to it. And like, I remember just, my parents had several of the albums, but they also had the, I don't know if it was a single or something, it was from Magical Mystery Tour and it was like a picture
EP,
book or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And it had Your Mother Should Know on there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I that was like the best thing I'd ever heard in my entire life when I listened to that song. And I, you know, as much as I could listen to it now and think, I don't know, but I still like it.
Mm.
I
think
it's that line. I like, there is even something like that where it's got this sort of music hall-y something, but there's something really pains me a bit. Mm. I find it painfully sad at a certain point in there.
Yeah, it's quite a nostalgic. There is a kind of like yearning in there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm.
It's quite idealistic. Again, it's another one that's a bit unfinished for me, that song. I'd quite like a little... It's a bit repetitive. And then Paul likes to do a verse of like... Da-da-da-da-da. another verse.
Yeah, it's not as appealing after that when he starts daring.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I like that you kind of mentioned it a couple of times, this idea of being drawn to music that has a very powerful emotional effect on you. I mean, I suppose it's fairly self-explanatory. But like, where did you kind of go to after the Beatles? What other music did you listen to before you started making your own music?
There was classical stuff. And I remember, you know, performances of like St. Matthew Passion, just finding that unbelievably emotional. And like not even knowing how to cope with the kind of emotional response to that.
Mm.
And Elgar's Dream of Gerontius. I remember my dad playing that and playing in that in Winchester Cathedral or somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, so that sort of thing. And then, you know, other music. I think a real, I don't know, touchstone for me was Julian Cope.
Oh, right.
That was someone who really, that kind of really opened me up. Whatever age I was, like 13, 14 or something. Mm-hmm. And that really influenced me. I feel like it's still, that's probably the music I've listened to most.
Right. That makes a lot of sense with your music. Yeah.
I mean, do you quite like sort of choral stuff then? Do you think that comes from singing in...
I guess choir, so, yeah. I mean, I don't sit around and listen to much choral stuff.
Yeah.
Mm. Does, do you know, who is it? It's Mendelssohn. Hear My Prayer.
Mm.
That's something I still listen to. I think that's wonderful. Yeah. But I don't really, to be honest, I don't listen to that much stuff from that time. I've just, you know, I went to a lot of concerts and, you know, sung in a lot of services and things like that.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's all in there. I remember once being at a wedding and talking to someone in that way, you know, what do you do?
Mm.
And saying, oh,
you're a waitress.
I'm a waitress. Yeah. what do you do? You know, I'm a musician. And they said, what kind of music do you make? And I found myself saying, I grew up singing in a choir and then I studied experimental music and then somehow put them together.
Mm. Yeah.
In that way, when you're trying to explain something in a sentence or something. And I thought, there's some truth in that.
Mm.
I definitely have the thing of every time I try and write a piece of music, I'm sure everyone feels like that, but every time I try and write a song, I think I have no idea how to write a song.
Mm.
And as sort of painful as that is in a way, I hope that that's a good thing in a way.
Mm.
Kind of make. I don't want to be prescriptive to myself and have a formula, more like, you know, this is how I'm going to do this.
Yeah. Do you ever approach it that kind of like workman-like way? I mean, that's what something that's so nice in Get Back. And Richard Thompson, I think, almost kind of does this thing where he sits at his desk, gets up at 9 to write songs or something.
Mm.
But like, I love in Get Back where, you know, John Lennon's says a thing about, you know, try and end a word with a D or, you know, get a strong sound at the end. You know, and all these little tricks they fall back on. Do you approach songwriting from that kind of quite working way? Like, I need to get this done by the end of the day and stuff?
I definitely like giving myself kind of tasks and stuff. And something I've done for this album and also did it for the last album. It started with a friend who's a writer and who's having trouble finishing things or doing stuff. So I said, why don't we just send something to each other twice a month?
Mm. Mm.
And he didn't really continue, but I just continued doing it. And then I've ended up doing it with a couple of friends.
Shane Fogarty. Did this through it as well.
Oh, did you? Yeah. and Leafcutter John.
Mm.
And we send each other something at 1st and 15th of the month. I sent something to them this morning.
I should get back into this. Mm.
And it's brilliant
because
it means you've got this deadline twice a month. So whatever happens, sometimes, you know, you have been doing quite a bit of work on something and then I submit it. Other times you think, well, I've been busy or whatever, so I'm going to set an alarm 20 minutes on my, you know. And sometimes I might work all day thinking, okay, I'm going to spend today doing that and can't get anywhere. So I just think, okay, I've got 20 minutes, 25 minutes, whatever, and go, whatever it is, that will be it. And having a deadline, but without the pressure of it's got to be any good, which I feel like is the best kind of combination of things to make a situation to make something.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel that you need some kind of motivation to do it, to push yourself, but you can't have the pressure of putting yourself to think, oh my God, this has got to be really good.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that I find that an unbelievably kind of inspiring way of doing it.
Yeah. What's the other great bit in Get Back? Is it John talking to George when George is writing something, isn't it?
Mm.
You just got to get something out, say anything.
Yeah, just put put cauliflower in come back and change it to something else when you think of it. Yeah. I guess getting it over the line that's the bit that I always really struggled with. Just having something that is something and then you can go back and... Yeah, I guess it's like a first draft.
What, sort of finishing it?
I'm too... I start resenting songs I write before they're done. Whereas actually, I think you just got to get it out and then go back and patch it up. And then before you know it, it's something that resembles quite good. But I just, the reason why I never kept on writing, I mean, I probably haven't done it for 5 or 6 years now. But I, you know, get really excited about, I'd write in sort of flurries.
Right.
Be really excited about something, come back to it a week later and just delete it all.
Oh, no.
I've got the thing, it's funny what you said about junk, that you like the early version. Mm. I've got this thing where I just can't stop mixing something. And
I remember and then you just, saying that before on something you were doing.
Yeah, just, and then you look at your files, you look in your drive and you see you're on version 78 and you last opened it in 2017. And you just think, I can't finish. I will never finish this.
Yeah.
But do you, when you write music, do you... When you mention that about junk, do you like the kind of first take kind of thing, the kind of keeping some of that spontaneity?
Yeah, I like... There's been other things I've done... Do you know about the immersion music method?
No.
Where you spend 12 hours, you put 12 hours aside and you aim to write 20 pieces of music. Mm. It doesn't matter if you don't reach 20 pieces of music, you just try and get as many as you can.
Yeah.
So every time I've done it, I think I've done it about 20 times in the last 20 years or something.
How long does the piece of music have to be?
Any length. There's no... Yeah. Just whatever. And that's brilliant because you do just get some... I mean, obviously, some of it's awful, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah.
It really doesn't matter. And it amazes you as well. You know, when you get to the end of the 12 hours and then you sit down and listen to them, you sort of almost don't remember doing them. And it's amazing the variety of... You'd think they'd all sound the same or something, but there's some unbelievable variety.
Right.
But there's a spark of something in the good ones. Mm. You think, oh, that's something I want to hold on to that.
Yeah.
That's so really I feel like it's quite... I like doing things in... You know, doing a burst of something... And then maybe leaving it, even if it's only for a few days, however long. Mm. And then you can come back to it with try and have a slightly different sort of mindset to think, okay, I'm going to edit that now. I'm going to.
That's cool. You know, and is this coming up with purely instrumental music?
Then? No.
Oh, right.
No.
I'm trying to come up with lyrics.
And that's really, one of the songs on the album I'm doing at the moment was something where I was like, I've been trying to make stuff and it's all rubbish. So I emailed the other two just to give myself permission. I'm just going to set my alarm for 20 minutes and whatever it is. And there's something amazingly freeing about, you've got no time to think. You just write some lyrics.
Yeah.
You know, I've played something and then I'll just write some lyrics and I'll just sing them. Mm. And there's something amazingly freeing about that you've got no time to worry about. So you just, and sometimes something comes out that you can't express.
Mm.
Sometimes it's rubbish, but
but that's it's a lovely approach, and I feel like you tap into something when you do that. I think like I was listening to Aldous Harding just on the walk here, that great song The Barrel, and that sounds like she's almost automatically written it, doesn't it? Because what's the line about show the ferret to the egg? You know, it just sounds like this kind of like thing you'd come up with, Flaming Pie style, but it kind of, because of the insistence on it, the repetition of it, and the fact that she's chosen to put it in the song, you start thinking about its meaning and you start thinking about what it's tapping into and stuff. It's very strange. It's a very strange song. Brilliant video as well.
Yeah, a big hat.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so cool.
Did you watch all of Get Back?
Yeah. Yeah,
what were your amazing thoughts on it?
I mean, I feel like I know nothing, so it's really good you've got me on this podcast.
good company.
So I'm sure there just must be so much I've met that passed me by in that, because I don't know any of the other characters, you know.
Mm. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But it was just wonderful. It's just, especially because it came in the time, you know, the last couple of years I have been. Thanks to your podcast, I've been you know, really revisiting that and listening to the Beatles so much, and so it's amazing to see that.
Mm.
Yeah, I loved it, and there's so much that strikes you about it, not knowing very much. Immediately, just how likable they all are, really, and how unself-conscious they seem to me. You know, I feel like most bands, if you saw them rehearsing with a film crew there, they'd all be on show in a way that maybe the Beatles are just so used to it.
But yeah, I think their tolerance for being sort of documented must get to a point where you're just saturated in it, and then I guess it was more candid than they'd be used to, but Was there anything from a sort of songwriting point of view that you found particularly interesting in Get Back? Yeah.
I mean, you know, the moment of Get Back is just incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, I'm sure everyone, that's the moment you think of most in a way.
Yeah.
I loved, to be honest, I watched half of it. I watched like the first half and the second half, you know, a while ago. And then recently I've gone back and watched all of it. So I only finished watching it this morning.
Yeah.
I watched the last bit of the third one. And watching the rooftop concert, but just because it's not like I've seen that a lot, but you have seen it.
Yeah.
Even if you haven't, you know, sorted it out. And I loved it, like when they turned up, it's like almost like, oh, they've come dressed as...
Yeah.
It's like, oh, look, Ringo's got that top, red thing on. It's like, oh, wow. And there's something, I think I found that all the way through, and there's something a bit like that in Anthology about the sort of versions that didn't make it onto the album. And actually, going back to Maxwell Silver Hammer, I found that there's something really stressful about watching some bits like that where you think, oh my God, don't stick with that version. Because as much as you probably don't like that song, that version where they, in the film where it sort of ends with that kind of dum dum. It's you know, you just think keep working at it. So seeing those things come together, but I guess consoling yourself that they did manage to get to the versions. But it's almost feeling like going back in time and sort of just going, oh, please, you know, George McFly and meet and
go to the dance. It's a bit like watching a sort of badly written biopic where they're just forcing you to get the payoff at the end.
I'm watching Get Back for a second time. I think I'm so fascinated by the day after, you know, where they recorded the songs they couldn't do on the roof. I'm sure, I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast.
Is that
before.
In the credits? Is that what the credits
are?
Yeah,
it's where they do Long and Winding Road and Two of Us. And,
it's a bit of an anti-climax,
but
it's so much part of the story.
That's kind of why I like it. It reminds me of the bit at the end of, you know, Willy Wonka, where he goes into Willy Wonka's office. Do you remember in the film and everything's cut in half?
Oh,
it's, really, he's in this really weird office, like his clock is cut in half, and he's got a bust.
Oh, wow. Probably turned it off after the actual end.
And so all of a sudden, Willy Wonka's this hard-working... You know, he's got letters.
Which
to
is
write.
Running a factory.
Yeah, he's running a factory. It's just so. It's just really feels
got
really
purchase orders.
And it feels. And then Charlie gives him the everlasting gobstopper, and he realizes that Charlie was a good guy and everything.
Right.
But this kind of strange atmosphere of being back in the adult world after the excitement of everything that's come before.
Right.
It's really kind of profound. And like I always think, like that when they're filmed doing like Two of Us, it's like they're in like some weird limbo. You know, like it sort of doesn't have anything to do with the rooftop console or everything that's gone before. It's sort of this such weird, like kind of, I don't know, like Beckett played vibe to it. I mean, I love those performances of those songs, but there's such a sadness to it.
Cause
you know it's coming to an end, and they all know that.
But it's like having a big sort of house party when you're moving out of the house, but then you've got to come the next morning and make sure that someone else can move in. So, because it's all very workmanlike, all that stuff, isn't it? It's just like, well, we need to get this stuff.
Yeah, it's like they're in heaven. I haven't really thought it out properly in my head. Yeah. Willy Wonka, the afterlife.
We'll come back to it.
It's a bit like in Lord of the Rings where it ends and then it goes on for another half an hour.
Oh my God.
So maybe that's just Peter Jackson's thing.
But it's good though. I mean, what I'm saying is I love that day, but there's something so sad about it as well.
Well, it's like it's that feeling of like leaving school or something, isn't it?
There is a sad. I definitely felt sad at the end, just thinking, "Oh, I want to keep watching this."
But there's a. I mean, I was listening to the Jan Wenner interview. You know, the famous Rolling Stone interview John Lennon did. He's basically a depressed person because he's saying, you know, if you ask someone who's depressed, like, who's annoyed you this time?
Is this the one where he's really sniffy about a lot of the Abbey Road stuff?
Oh, he's appalling about everyone. Oh, really? George Martin was very, very offended by it, you know, and all this. But like, he should the problem was you should never have been taken at his word because he's clearly exaggerating and in a depressive state, I feel, because when you're depressed, you don't just say this is bad, you say everything's bad.
Yeah.
And that's what he's doing there. And it's just, it's sort of just so sad to see, think of John in that early 69, where there is that enthusiasm and positivity, and think of him at the end of the year.
So a year of smack probably doesn't help.
Imagine a band that you were in your 20s, and when it ended, however it ended, and however maybe on the surface it was fine, if Rolling Stone interviewed you, and amplified by thousands, you can imagine the things you could say and not really mean them. And
oh, totally.
Especially when you're like him, who's incapable of being diplomatic. Yes, I do remember the George Martin comments. What does he say about George Martin?
I can't remember the exact things, but it took George Martin visiting him to bring it up, and John Lennon saying like, oh, I was off my head, I didn't know what I was saying.
Basically implied that he was a bit of a hanger-on, really, didn't he?
Yeah, he calls Paul Engelbert Humperdinck at one point. About She's Leaving Home. What was it about that song that moved you to tears?
I couldn't even answer that question. And that's what I mean. That's what I love about stuff. And I'm not too keen to interrogate that usually. There's something just visceral about it. I mean, there's something. I guess when you listen to that as a child, you definitely feel that person has had to leave home, and you're with them, and then. Listening to it now, I don't know. You don't know the situation. How bad were the parents?
Yeah.
But how bad was the child? You know? I don't know. But so there's something, you know, as soon as you try and think about it, but there's something just very, like you're saying about Paul's thing. Is that a Paul song, I presume?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Like something very direct, isn't it?
Beautiful storytelling.
Sort of anguish in there.
Yeah.
Sort of longing, and I don't know. I don't know why. Why is that?
Yeah.
Why is
that? Why I nearly burst into tears quite recently watching an interview with the harpist who played that part. Because now she's sort of in her kind of whatever she must be, 70s or 80s. And she, you know, just tells the story that isn't particularly interesting of how they just, like every session when you're that good, they just plot the music on, and then she plays it perfectly, but it's so exactly like it is on the record. And there was something about this sort of nicely lit shot of this old woman playing this song that I don't think she probably had played it since she had played it in there. It's really emotional. I'll try and find the link to it and put it in the podcast description.
He didn't tell me at the time that it was for the Beatles. You never knew who you were going to play with. And I was sitting here at 8:30, tuning the harp, thinking of nothing in particular. Suddenly a piece of music was plonked on my music stand. I gave it a brief look. Oh, yeah, right. And then this voice said, well, what you got on the dust? Meaning, what's written on the music? I recognised the Liverpool accent, turned round, of course, it was Paul McCartney. Well, first of all, I played exactly what was written, which is, I'm reading the music here. Into that.
I think the subject matter is sad, but it's just, I mean, the harp is a fantastic choice.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine there were too many harps on rock and roll records in 1967. But it's not sort of, I guess harps can be a bit sort of slushy, and it is a sentimental song, but it's not sort of managed just to steer away from corny in a way that Paul is usually walking that kind of tightrope with these sort of things. But it's just used in such a sensitive way because it's not trying to be sort of magical or overly romantic.
There's something quite I love that song. Everyday about it at the same time. There's some
it's just your average person.
And sublime, I don't know.
Yeah. What were the key albums that your parents had when you were...
I think they had, like... Beatles for Sale, Revolver, and Sergeant Pepper. That's probably those ones. Those were when I was, you know, little. Those were the ones I really listened to a lot. And Help. That's the other one. So I guess that period, whatever that was. I mean, to be honest, it really surprised me. I didn't know. I've never been very good at knowing how things are made or when they're made.
Yeah.
You know, those kind of details. So it really surprised me to look back and realise how short a period they were all made in. It sort of blew my mind. Mm. It's like a few years ago, I watched that film about Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
You know, what's it?
Love and Mercy.
Love and Mercy. Yeah. And, you know, I've always, you know, I like the Beach Boys. I've got bad sounds. But it really made me understand, you know, I felt that was an amazing film because it made you really understand something about that. I don't usually like music biopics. And I read his book that his autobiography, although it's that one.
Oh, where he's, be nice, that one.
It's the one where he's still under the sort of influence. Yeah, yeah. But it's amazing to, you know, again, with that they made, like, I don't know, 13 albums in how short a period of time. It just absolutely blows my mind.
Yeah. But it's a bit like that thing of deadlines, that how, you know, the, how useful, and they had to get albums out by to make Christmas markets or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And then you don't have time to overthink things. I thought probably a lot of stuff would have been redone on Rubber Soul, and if they'd had too much time to do it. There's something nice and raw about the finished ones that you wouldn't want anyone going back to and fiddling with, really.
Yeah, because so many things you can, like, in a song you love, there can be moments where it's little mistakes, but you love those mistakes.
Yeah, there were quite a lot on those, especially on Rubber Soul and less so on Revolver, but Rubber Soul's got lots of badly timed stuff, but it's all part of the charm, and you wouldn't want that to be ever cleared up.
It blew me away watching Get Back as well, the way I didn't really realise that they recorded those live.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
I mean, that's, I've never, and you know, like on, like with that new box set and the anthologies and stuff where it says take 33 or something, you're like, oh wow, they played that many times. It's more like a film, you know, sort of doing a film scene. That's just a completely alien way of making music.
It is now, for sure. Just for the limitations we have, you have to multi-track, you know. It's weird. It was such a luxury in the 60s to multi-track, but now it's like, if you want to make an album,
I just think when you get to that many tracks, though, you must be like, is it good anymore? Yeah. Do you, like, I tell you what, 24, it's either 24 or 27.
I can imagine a lot of situations where you'd be like, this will be good. We just need 4 more tracks. We need to get up to 6. If we get a 16-track recorder, this band is going to hit the big time. I mean, I started making music on 4 tracks, and I think that's, I don't want to be, you know, middle-aged man saying it was better because we learned it. But there was definitely something in that to learn, that you know, the way you have to be concise with things and bounce things down, and that's it.
And also, like, a great thing about 4-track was the live mixing you had to do if you were bouncing to, like, a master. That was all good.
I know. I remember in that band Brothers in Sound, remember Andy getting these 4-track recordings from maybe Sgt. Pepper or something, and listening to the 4 parts and just thinking, oh my God. I mean, there were things that were bounced, but still, it was amazing, you know, especially because we were making stuff on 4-track, so it really
highlighted. The technology is fundamentally the same.
It's
mad, isn't it?
And I feel that growing up and starting to make music, you had more of a connection with something like the Beatles, so you could listen to it and have some kind of understanding of what that was. But if I've no idea, like, how was Duran Duran? What is Duran Duran? You know, is that
Duran Duran?
Don't you have any concept of what that is in a room or sitting down and making it?
But I mean, for reasons that I can't really explain. I watched the video for Spies Like Us today.
That was something I thought about recently. I thought, I want to watch that again.
And it's got the Duran Duran thing where it's just like, what is that drum? Like, what is this meant to sound like? The video is him in Abbey Road. He's got this really naff sweater on. And it's like as if he's playing it live. It's just, it doesn't sound anything like a live band.
Really?
Yeah, amazing. It's so strange.
Thank you.
There's a very interesting Guardian review of Ludovico Einaudi.
Oh, I read that. Yeah.
No matter what. Yeah. I mean, he writes a lot of very kind of big soundtracky. And it was a 1-star review. And I just remember thinking it was such an interesting review because he ends it by saying, you know, the audience are enraptured, but why? They haven't been listening to anything. And I thought that was, it's really interesting. And I remember at the time the comments were really interesting because people were saying like, well, you know, you could play G and then C. And that's a very pleasing chord sequence. And you just play that over and over again. And that could be a really good piece of music. But what gives instrumental music substance? Why for this reviewer, is Einaudi's music lacking in substance?
The suggestion I got was that he's a bit of a charlatan.
Yeah. But like, so it's just
a Uri Geller kind of.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose Uri Geller is far from obvious, but yeah. But yeah, a charlatan, yeah. So what, pulling tricks, doing tricks?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And being quite deliberately lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
And it's like sort of musical populism for people that go to the Barbican.
Yeah.
But like, £60 to watch a sort of big name musician, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I'm not personally not a fan of Ludovico Einaudi, but a lot of the music I really like is very simple. Mm. So what's, as a kind of devil's advocate, difference?
And I guess you can't claim to know what the intention behind them either.
Yeah.
But there's simple and then there's obvious. I mean,
yes,
I feel like there's a difference.
That's true.
In that.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes if you hear something, you just think, oh, that's so obvious.
Yeah.
I have that with Philip Glass, actually. There's some stuff I like, but I really think a lot of it is, you know, simple for this. Obviously, that's what it's meant to be. But musically, I find it, I don't like things that are sort of intellectual exercise.
Mm. You know,
it's the antithesis of the kind of music that I liked and studied and stuff.
Yeah.
I like big, huge, romantic, sweeping, really complicated, virtuosic. You know. So I guess there's an element of that.
Yeah. Well, it's almost genre exercise, isn't it? I think some Philip Glass has got that sound. What I was trying to talk about earlier, actually, that modern minimalist sound. You play a certain sequence of notes on the piano,
but
in a kind of austere way, you'll get something quite close to that Philip Glassy sound, right?
You do, but I think the end product's never really that interesting. And I like the sort of people like Messiaen who will use kind of quite arbitrary sequences or techniques to make something that is, you know, adheres to some kind of like structure that's quite mathematical.
Yeah.
But he does it in a way and with an instrumentation or whatever it is, where it doesn't feel so cerebral. It's more musical. I guess that's my problem with Philip Glass, is it doesn't sound very musical to me.
Yeah. But that's why I think Jan's music is so good. And I'm not just saying this because, you know, but he can write very simple music that's, really simple, just 4 chords or 2 chords. But there's something so felt about it, and it's so genuine, and it kind of conveys a naive quality sometimes. And it's just so interesting that that is not a million miles away from what someone like Ludovico was trying to do.
Right.
Why does that sound naff and Jand can sound so good?
A theory would be that your intention as a writer comes through in it sort of tacitly, and you might be able to, your receptors might be able to pick up on how it's written, you know, and the intention it's written with. I don't know. That would be my sort of guess. I didn't see the concert, so obviously I have no way of knowing.
I'll tell you what I think is a really good example of songwriting going wrong. Travis.
Right, okay.
Writing to Reach You, okay.
Beautiful song,
what's that? It's a song from The Man Who. I think it's a really good song, except it goes bad.
The chorus.
In the same song.
Because my inside is outside.
That's a good bit.
My right side is on my left side, because I'm writing to reach
That's
you.
A lovely change.
Boom, boom, I'll never reach you.
That's bad. That's
it's major
really,
minor.
That's
what's
really
wrong with
bad.
A major minor?
That, see, that... Lovely. It's terrible. That's bad. The only way to
Yeah, maybe. You?
That's so naff.
I don't know. I'm a big Travis apologist.
Like, but that song is so good, and it's like, if you like, songwriting is all about decisions, isn't it? So like, you've got that amazing hook, and then you just, it kind of just goes,
just loses really its way, obvious
change at the end.
Yeah.
The only way to teach you.
Yeah, I mean, it's very poppy stuff.
Yeah. Sorry if you're listening, Trav.
I really think there's something amazing about stuff that that feels wrong to you as well. There's something, I think it's one of the most wonderful things in life, that, you know, with a film or music or anything, where you can just listen to something or watch something and think, I love this.
Yeah.
And I love every decision that has led to this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that is wonderful. And you can also watch something and think, this is terrible.
Yeah.
But it's sort of the same spectrum. It's amazing. Yeah. And that different people could totally have the same different responses to something.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's wonderful. It's like magic.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
And even that sort of thing where the decisions leading up to a certain part in the song, you're like, yes!
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're like, no!
Yeah, exactly.
There's a song I've on an album that I like, and I won't say who it is, but it starts, and the first, the opening line is just amazing.
Right.
I absolutely love it. And then it repeats the same line, and I just,
yeah.
What a waste.
Yeah.
So before you go, Ed, we'll just ask you the question we ask everyone on the podcast. Do you have a controversial Beatles opinion?
Now, obviously, as a listener of the podcast, I'm aware of this question, and it's a hard one, especially for someone who doesn't know anything. So you don't know what's a controversial opinion, for one. Mm-hmm. One, I kept having these sort of really ridiculous, really controversial opinions, but then realizing, no, I don't agree with that at all. Like when I started rewatching Get Back, I started to not like George very much. But it's unfair, and I don't agree with that, and I'm not going to come on a Beatles podcast and say, you know what, I don't like George Harrison.
when he gets Mal Evans, just go and buy
but
some
I think
shoes.
there's something about, I think the only thing is in that first episode, he's holding something back. I feel like the others are a lot more direct. Maybe I'm totally wrong. Seems like he's holding back. And also, there's something I could read about that kind of, and knowing and feeling, you know what it feels like to be not the best person in the room, but still want to have your voice heard, and how you deal with that and stuff. So I think I totally don't believe in that. I think he's, you know, and the thing that's wonderful about the Beatles is everything about the Beatles.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really annoys, I try not to go on this team, one of the things that really annoys me about that James Corden film, Yesterday.
James Corden,
isn't it? Yeah, he's in it. Sorry,
to make it even worse.
Yeah. But there's something about that where it
James
kind
Corden
of,
and Ed Sheeran are in there.
Yeah.
I've forgotten.
I remember talking to you about it at the time when I watched it, because I think you spoke about it, and it was in the moment. I really enjoyed it more than I thought it would. It's something you know, you're kind of enjoying something about the Beatles. But what I hated about it, apart from a lot of things, was it kind of completely erases the band. It's like the idea that these songs, which are amazing, like some of the best songs ever written, but the guy that someone's just singing could sing that, and everyone's going to turn their head and go, oh my God, that's the best thing
ever. Yeah, as if you didn't need the four.
Totally. There's something really fundamental about that, really annoyed me. Anyway,
yeah, that's a really good point.
So I guess my opinion really is just, and I don't even know if it's a controversial opinion, is that I totally love Real Love and Free as a Bird. I mean, that's probably, I don't know how people feel about this these days. I think there was probably some sniffiness at the time. But I just, I remember hearing those when they came out and just being utterly bewitched, this kind of passing in time. And even, I think Real Love is done with love. I hope you're not going to tell me, you know, there's some horrible acrimonious thing that happened in the background.
No, I don't think so.
But I think they're absolutely wonderful. And also going back to that average person thing, not with that, but I listened to the Frog Chorus recently, and I mean, it's not like the best thing he ever did, but it's, I think it's pretty wonderful, and yeah. I still mm-hmm. love it.
It's great.
And it's amazing that it's got this reputation of like, oh, the Frog Chorus, when average person exists.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely not the worst thing he ever did.
Yeah.
But I think what is the reputation of, I think Three as a Bird is thought of more fondly as Real Love, because really? I think Real Love, people knew the demo better.
I think it's just like anything, like even, you know, the Revolver box set. There are people who love it and there are people who don't love it. And I think it was similar in the 90s, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. My most watched bit of the anthology probably is them back in the studio in the DVD extras when they're making those.
Really?
So I just love to see them back playing. And even though they're obviously, George is really there for the money. Sure. And it's quite obvious. Yeah. but I think as Paul says he prefers Free as a Bird because he got to have some input in it because he wrote the bridge or whatever. Whereas the other one, I guess people feel like, oh, it's the song's finished and it's a John song and it doesn't sound quite as Beatly.
I think Free as a Bird's lovely. I think the chords are lovely. Yeah. The video was so brilliant and still is.
I remember watching that on Top of the Pops when they premiered it, and that was pretty awesome. Incredible.
I still find the video really moving.
Yeah. And we mentioned it before, but the guitar solo is fantastic.
Yes, it's great.
No one's ever professed their love for the for the anthology singles, so that's a good controversial opinion. So that was our chat with the fantastic Ed Dowie, who is a really lovely man, as I'm sure you have worked out yourselves. Thank you so much to Ed for coming and joining us and sharing some personal Beatles with us, and really recommend his albums and very excited to hear what's coming.
It was such a good chat.
Next week, we're going to take a little bit of a breather, a sort of mid-season break, if you will, because I'm going on holiday to New York City. The Windy Apple. So we'll have something for you next week, but it's not going to be a normal episode. So we won't tease who it's going to be. It will be something from the vaults, which most of you won't have heard before. But we'll keep it as a surprise, shall we?
Yeah, sounds good.
Let's say it is mentioned in this episode. I should say that the documentary piece that I was talking about with the harpist who played on She's Leaving Home in the Sgt. Pepper sessions, the link to the full interview there's in the description. I was really struggling to find it because I couldn't remember where I'd seen it. I thought it was probably at, you know, Sheffield Documentary Festival or Venice or something. Turns out it's from the One Show. It's still really good. Mm. And then there's an interview with her and Ringo afterwards, which is really funny. And Ringo is on superb form.
Nice.
If you can ignore Chris Evans's interjections. So check that out in the old description. Should we do a bit of Weekly Wings?
Yeah, take it away.
Take it away.
So this week on Weekly Wings, it's a song from Back to the Egg.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the last Wings album. It doesn't have a great reputation, let's say, but the song I really, really like, the song that really struck me when I first listened to it, is a really, really short song called We're Open Tonight, which is only a minute and a half long. It's kind of weird, because in the context of this semi-conceptual album, which is about a kind of band going on tour, and it's got all this bombast on it, there's the kind of what's the big song? The rockestra theme. And, you know, it's got some real kind of glam rock, almost new wavy moments in it. There's this really kind of short acoustic song. And there's something very beautiful about it. And I really love the two guitars playing off against each other.
Mm.
Paul was playing this figure on the acoustic guitar. And the guitarist Lawrence Juber got his 12-string guitar out of his case. And it was in this weird tuning.
Right.
And so he played along to the same thing. But the strings sound really kind of, the way they harmonize is really nice. I wonder if it's a 12-string and if like one of the kind of duplicate strings was detuned against the other one, if you see what I mean.
Yeah,
possibly. You get those kind of naturally ringing harmonies. So it's a really lovely kind of moment in kind of quite an odd album.
Yeah, I don't know this album at all, really. And I will admit that, I mean, I must have heard it before, but it didn't sort of ring any bells, really. But yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, it's a great exercise in what you can do with melody when you're using two chords. Not even really. I mean, it's a major and a minor chord. That's it. Which is, and I think it obviously it doesn't outstay its welcome at 90 seconds.
No.
But it's interesting in the context of what we were talking about in this episode with Ed Dowie, because we're talking about sort of songs that are impossible to finish. This is just a great little sort of sketch or a vignette, if you're being pretentious, I suppose. I mean, it's very, a lot of this Wingsy stuff is very sort of atmospheric and theatrical, and just makes me think it's unbelievable that Paul McCartney's never made like a big West End musical.
Yeah.
All of this stuff would suit it perfectly, really.
Definitely. And also in the context of this conceptual album, it's like, well, what is this song actually doing? I mean, it's saying like, we're open tonight. Okay, it's like, we're a band, we're going to do a gig. But the actual kind of genre of the song, like, what is it? It's like a really weird dual guitar kind of piece, you know?
Yeah, and it is a kind of acoustic number, but you couldn't describe it as stripped back.
No.
You know, it's very heavily produced and there's tons of instruments on it and xylophones.
Yeah, the Paul McCartney Project website, which is really, really such a great resource, quotes from Lawrence Juber, and he says there's a wah-wah guitar, there's tremolo guitar, volume pedal on the bass, glockenspiel and backing vocals and bongos. So for 90 seconds, hell of a lot going on.
Yeah, extraordinary song. Check it out. So we will be back soon. Can't give you a full date, but there'll be something in your feeds next week and we'll be back with a little Christmas special. I think we can probably tell you what it is.
Yeah.
If you enjoyed our covers challenge that we did last year with Johnny White, Really, Really, we're very pleased to say that he's back. We've chosen our songs. We're working on them, beavering away, as it were. And we'll give you the results of that in a Christmas special coming in a few weeks' time. So all that to look forward to. Continue to leave nice reviews about the podcast, if you so wish, on Apple Podcasts, and get in touch with us. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Keep bloody beatling on.
Keep beatling on.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.